The Upper Cumberland is filled with rich history that helped to shape our country to what we live in today. Join Abbott historian Troy Smith as he will tell you tales of characters and events that happened in your backyard. Mountain True starts now.
Hello, my name is Troy Smith, and I am an associate professor of history at Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville. And this is part of our ongoing local history podcast that we have christened Mountain True, true stories about the Upper Cumberland. My background, in addition to being a history professor, is in my day job. That's my day job. In my night job, I am also a novelist, author of fiction. You can check out my website, www.troyduanesmith.com. That's D-U-A-N-E. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about some information that I have discovered in recent years about the history of the African-American community in the Upper Cumberland and more specifically in White County. There have been a few things down through the years that have been written on the topic, but when I was doing research for my novel about Champ Ferguson, the local Confederate guerrilla, the novel's called Good Rebel Soil, I was going through the records of the Civil War. There's a collection of books that have been digitized and are available online called the Official Record of the War of the Rebellion that has all the orders and reports given by both sides during the Civil War. And I came across some interesting stuff in there that I'll tell you about in a moment. And also I came across some interesting stuff when I was going through what's called the WPA slave narratives. During the Great Depression, when the FDR administration was starting various different organizations and groups to try to find ways to spend money on sort of infrastructure things and projects that needed to be done, and at the same time provide employment for unemployed people, one of the organizations was the Works Progress Administration, or the WPA. They did a lot of things, kind of like the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, a lot of building projects. But there was one special project that the government sponsored through WPA that employed unemployed journalists and teachers in the South and parts of the Midwest, and essentially hired them to go out and find every living ex-slave that they could and interview them. And they actually had these interview sheets with some uniform questions that they asked them. This also has been digitized and is available online to read through, the WPA slave narratives. If you Google that, you can find access to it. And I was going through there doing research for another of my projects, a novel that I wrote called Bound for the Promised Land, which is one of my proudest achievements, that book. It was something that dealt with the meaning of liberty and sort of follows the trajectory of a slave in the 19th century. Anyhow, I came across some interesting stuff about Sparta in both of those resources. And as I continued to dig, I found more interesting things. So first, to talk about what I found in the WPA slave narrative. In Oklahoma, there was a 75-year-old woman who was interviewed. Her name was Josie Jordan, and she was interviewed in 1936. She had been born in Sparta, Tennessee, around 1860. So during the Civil War, she was a very little girl. So she would have been, 4 or 5 years old when it finally ended. And in her interview, she was talking about life as a slave on a plantation in White County, Tennessee. Her mother had gone through several owners. She had been sold and resold several times. ultimately winding up in the possession of Mark Lowry in White County. So one story in particular that she told is very, very interesting. It's a story about the Lowry family and their hogs. Now, things were rough during the Civil War, obviously, for people in the South. It was a time of great privation. And the Lowry family had a few hogs that they were going to slaughter, with the meat being intended to provide for the family through the winter. Now, that was for the family, the master's family, the slave owners, not for the slaves. They weren't going to get any of this. Well, one morning, Mark Lowry went down to the hog pen, and he saw his hogs all laid out on the ground dead. And there was an elderly slave, an older black man, that was kneeling down and examining the hogs. And Mr. Lowry said, "What happened to my hogs?" And the older man said, "This looks like a sure enough case of mellitus. M-A-L-I-T-U-S is the way that that it was spelled in this interview. Well, Mark Lowry had no idea what mellitus was, but it didn't sound good, and he didn't want to look stupid, you know, in front of his slaves by showing his ignorance. So since the old man seemed quite concerned about this, Lowry said, "That doesn't sound good. I tell you what, you people can have this meat." So Lowry left, and the little girl, Josie, who would be telling this story as an old woman in the 1930s, she asked her mother, she said, "Mama, what is mellitus?" And her mama said, "Mellitus is when a great big black man gets up real early in the morning and goes down to the hog pen with a mallet." So, of course, what had happened was that they had killed the hogs, and they had sort of scammed their master into thinking they had died of disease. And so they came out with the meat. This is a story that has shown up in several books about the history of slavery as an example of nonviolent resistance, that the sorts of things that slaves sometimes did. But it took place right in White County. And in fact, I was walking around the old city cemetery in Sparta, that's up on the hill behind the square, not long after I had first read this interview, and I happened to look down, and by golly, there's Mark Lowry, or at least his headstone in that grave, which brought it all a lot closer to home. Now, another thing that can bring the war and slavery closer to home, if you're from Sparta, is Hunter Funeral Home. If you've passed through town, or especially if you're from town, you're familiar with that business. It has been there for, I think, since the 1880s. It's been in operation. So in just a moment, I will tell you how that is connected to this topic. But first, a brief word. This is Mountain True, and today we're discussing African-American history, antebellum, pre-Civil War in the Upper Cumberland. I'm your host, Troy Smith, on the Hints and Oakley Podcast Center, providing for your family's dental care, now featuring Zoom teeth whitening. Make your appointment today. You'll be on your way to a dazzling smile, the type that you probably are no doubt wearing right now, listening to my stories. Henson Oakley Family Dentistry, West Jackson Street in Cookeville. All right, well, back to our story and back to the connection to Hunter Funeral Home. Well, for this, we have to go back almost 200 years and look at the life of a man named Braxton Hunter, who I believe he had originally been from North Carolina. He had gone to seminary and become a pastor. He was a Methodist preacher, if I recall correctly, And he had attended seminary in Cincinnati at the seminary that was run by Lyman Beecher. Now, Lyman Beecher was famous at that time as a theologian and also as a very outspoken abolitionist. In fact, his whole family, all of his kids, would become very active in the efforts to end slavery. He had a son named Henry Ward Beecher, who would sort of replace Lyman Beecher as one of the foremost voices of the abolitionist movement in subsequent years. He also had a daughter named Harriet Beecher, who later married and became Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. So very prominent abolitionist family that was running this seminary. When Braxton Hunter was attending, the son of Lyman Beecher, Henry Ward Beecher, was his roommate, and they became best friends to the extent that later on Braxton Hunter named his son Henry Ward Beecher Hunter. That name, the name Beecher, as well as the name Hunter, have sort of come down through the generations, not just in that family, but in other families in White County that I believe was due to the prominence of the Hunter family. So Braxton Hunter moved to White County initially. But over time, when Putnam County was formed, his house didn't move, but it went from being White County to Putnam County. He was, not surprisingly, Braxton Hunter, that is, he was an abolitionist, and he was a pro-union man, which was not the most popular thing to be in White County during the Civil War. It was overwhelmingly pro-Confederate, although there was a minority who were not. After the war was over, Braxton Hunter became the Freedmen's Bureau agent for Putnam County. The Freedmen's Bureau was a government agency set up to help primarily freed slaves to sort of get readjusted and get a start in life, although it also helped other people who had been rendered homeless or refugees by the war who might have been white as well. But primarily it was for the freedmen. Once Hunter said that while he was serving in this capacity, it was not uncommon for people to walk up to him on the streets of Cookeville and spit in his face for representing the federal government in efforts to help the freed slaves, which is a sad testament, but at the same time, a demonstration of sort of the fortitude that Braxton Hunter had. I kind of think of him as a forgotten and unsung hero of the Upper Cumberland. By the way, after his stint as agent of the Freedmen's Bureau, he became, I think he was the first superintendent of schools for Putnam County. Now, when it comes to antebellum or Civil War African-American history in the region, I mentioned earlier there's some things that I discovered that had previously not really been known. I mean, they were known at the time, but they had been lost to history in all the things that have been written about black communities in the Upper Cumberland. No one had quite hit on this, but when I was going through the records of the War of the Rebellion, like I mentioned earlier, I was looking for references to Champ Ferguson because at the time I was writing a book about him, and I was looking for all the references to Sparta. And this led me to a report that was made on March 28th, 1864 by Colonel William Brickley Stokes of the 5th Tennessee Union Cavalry. William Brickley Stokes was from the Upper Cumberland, a Union man, obviously, and commander of Union cavalry. He was located in Sparta, headquartered at the Methodist Church in Sparta, which is now First United Methodist Church, which is where my family and I attend. They had made the church their temporary headquarters, and some of the folks in the church are still upset about this. They tore out the sanctuary floor and made it into a stable. That may have been because the Methodist Church there in Sparta was the home church of Confederate General George Dibrell. So there may have been a little bit of revenge going on there in that aspect. Anyway, as I'm reading through the reports about Stokes trying to catch Champ Ferguson, he just may had this one line near the end of the report where he said, "Lieutenant Colonel Corbin of the 14th United States Colored Infantry is in Sparta, recruiting heavily." Now, being from Sparta, when I came across that reference, I was a little surprised because I had never heard anything. It's been about 15 years ago that I found that initially. I had never heard anything about Black Union soldiers in Sparta. And asking around, not too many people knew about this at all. So it seemed seemed to stand out. So I started doing some digging down through the years in what I laughingly call my spare time. And I discovered some things about the 14th United States Colored Infantry and their connection to the Upper Cumberland. Now, as you probably are aware, in 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and that announced the freedom of slaves in any area that was under rebellion. After that, the Union Army started enlisting African American men to serve in the military, enlisting a total of around 200,000 black men, about 180,000 in the U.S. Army and another 20,000 in the Navy. These units were segregated with black soldiers, but the officers and sometimes, at least initially, the non-commissioned officers were white. In Tennessee, there were several such regiments formed. The 14th United States Colored Infantry was formed up in Gallatin in November of 1863. It was commanded by Thomas Jefferson Morgan, who was a northern abolitionist, a very religious man, and his second in command was Lieutenant Colonel Henry Corbin. So they were formed in Gallatin, and then they were assigned to Chattanooga. So they went to Chattanooga. They didn't have a full regiment yet. They had recruited basically enough people to get started, but they still needed more. So Lieutenant Colonel Corbin was sent on a recruiting mission with some of his men, and he was specifically ordered to go to Sparta, Tennessee, and start recruiting. And by the time he had traveled from Chattanooga and then to Sparta, where he was enlisting black men there, by the time it was all said and done, he had recruited 120 men. Now, that doesn't mean that 120 of them came from White County, but one would assume, since that's where he was located, that a large number of them probably did. The others came from surrounding counties who had made their way to Sparta upon hearing that the Union Army was there recruiting. And then a handful of them were recruited along the way as they were on that trip from Chattanooga. Well, I wrote a paper about this, presented it at a conference, the fact that the 14th United States Colored Infantry had a pretty large component of soldiers from the Upper Cumberland and even specifically from White County. And someone asked a question I hadn't thought of. It was an obvious question. So why hadn't I thought of it? I don't know, but no one else had either. Why'd they come to Sparta? That made me dig a little bit more, and I discovered, to my surprise, when I looked at the census records from 1860, county by county, I found that in White County, there were 8,074 white people in the 1860 census, 1,145 slaves, and 162 free black people. 162. That was way, way more than any surrounding county. In fact, it was almost as much as several surrounding counties put together. And it was, in fact, the largest number of free black people in anywhere between the Nashville area and the Knoxville area. So certainly in the Upper Cumberland, it was by far the largest free black community. Now, how did that wind up happening? I went a little bit farther back and discovered something from the 1820 census. Now, Sparta, White County was established in 1806. 1810 would have been the first census. But those records for the whole state of Tennessee were lost in a fire. So 1820 is as far back as we can go. I discovered that in 1820, there were already 127 free blacks living in White County, and significantly fewer white people. So it's probably proportion-wise, a larger percentage. Now, again, I'd never heard about this. I had not been aware of such a thing, and I wondered why there would be such an influx, because these folks would have moved in, most of them, in the early years of the county. I came across a reference, actually a speech that was given by the governor of Tennessee to the state legislature in 1815, in which he was complaining about the large number of free blacks moving to Tennessee from Virginia. And when I saw that, it all kind of made sense, because, you know, in the early years of the 19th century, the early 1800s, there had been an unsuccessful slave uprising. It got discovered before it came to fruition, known as Gabriel's Rebellion, that really stoked the fears of Virginians about slave uprisings. And fearful that free blacks would be on hand to help slaves, as had been the case in this insurrection, to help slaves to plan such an insurrection, the state of Virginia started passing really harsh laws against the rights of free black people living there. And this led to an exodus of free black people out of Virginia and into Tennessee, which, and a lot of folks don't know this, was a place that, for a slave state in the Upper South, probably at that particular point in time, was a more attractive place to live if you were a free person of color. There was, in fact, in East Tennessee, a significant abolitionist movement at that time. So all these things sort of came together to lead to the growth of this free black community, plus the fact that there were over 1,100 slaves. So that with the place being occupied by the Union Army, those slaves were now free, those slave men, to join the army if they wished. So Lieutenant Corbin came through, and he got all those recruits, those who were capable of combat, who were in good enough shape for combat, were inducted into the 14th. Those who stepped forward to volunteer but were too young or too old or not deemed physically fit enough for combat were inducted into the 42nd United States Colored Infantry, which served the war in Chattanooga doing basically garrison duty or guard duty. So Here we go with this large number of Upper Cumberland black men fighting in the Union Army during the Civil War. Something that has, as I said, been lost to history. Everyone's sort of forgotten about this. Why would that be? Well, as I looked over the record of the 14th USCT, I saw that they were involved in many battles, and they gained a lot of distinction, especially in the Battle of Nashville. They were singled out for praise by General Thomas, the Union commander, for their valor under fire. But I also discovered something else. I discovered that they were in a couple of minor battles / skirmishes that are significant to our story. One was in Dalton, Georgia. The other was near Murfreesboro, a place called Reedyville. In both those engagements, they took the field opposite the 8th Tennessee Confederate Cavalry, which was made up of men from Sparta, so white men from Sparta, in some cases maybe even their former masters. And in both cases, the Union soldiers got the upper hand. In fact, there were some companies of the 14th that were present at Reedyville in what has come to be known as the Reedyville Stampede, because the 8th Tennessee Cavalry, commanded by General George Dibrell, was routed, and they basically took to flight and ran from the field in retreat, and it was extraordinarily embarrassing. And when you look at interviews that were conducted of Confederate veterans 50 years later, many of them were still embarrassed to talk about this incident. And if you take into account the fact that some of those Union soldiers were former slaves from White County, that might explain also some of the embarrassment or the reluctance of people in the black community to talk about it much after the war. Because as you probably know, once Reconstruction was over and the Jim Crow era began, it was really not safe probably to bring too much attention to the white people you had killed during the war. Another factor is that during this time, a large number of African Americans, former slaves and former, people who had been free to begin with, a lot of them moved away from Tennessee. There was this thing called the Exoduster Movement, in which large numbers of them moved out to Kansas and Oklahoma, which, to bring things full circle, back to the beginning of my discussion about the African-American community, that's how Josie Jordan, the old lady in Oklahoma who had been from Sparta, that's how she wound up out there. So while the war was going on and while those soldiers were being recruited, another thing that had happened is that they had been used by Colonel Stokes to augment his forces in his efforts to hunt down Champ Ferguson and other guerrillas. There were a couple of different diarists in the area that wrote about this. Amanda McDowell, who had kept a diary, she was a pro-Union schoolteacher in White County, who kept a diary about events through the war. She mentioned this, the fact that there were black soldiers, as adding insult to injury on the part of the Yankees, and she was pro-Union. Over in Warren County, there was a woman named Lucy Virginia French, who also was outraged by the fact that black soldiers had been used in the fighting against local white men who were guerrillas. So, obviously that's not the sort of thing that either side would have kept alive in memory because of the circumstances. All this just demonstrates how much history still lies hidden under the surface, in many cases yet to be discovered. This really is a fascinating area And it is full of so many good stories, which I look forward to having the opportunity to share more with you. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Mountain True. Download your favorites and keep up with new episodes in the Henson Oakley Podcast Center.